Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live for this Monday edition, 101.3 KPCG. On today's program, Germany is on the move, and it's explained in the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll have a preview of that for you. Also, more animals are dying at the zoo. Seems like it's been going around. This happened at a Knoxville zoo. We have details about that. And more and more working Americans are failing one thing, and it's a pretty important thing. Details about that and quite a few other stories coming up on this Monday edition, Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm, and we have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. This is the Monday edition. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here today, and we were chit-chatting a little bit before coming on the air, and Grant was telling us an epic tale of catching and killing a fish, and now he's absolutely exhausted. It's quite the battle. You versus the whale, and you won.
It might as well have been Moby Dick. Yeah, it was pretty tiring for some reason. It was just a pretty big fish, and then I had to kill it, so it's kind of violent and bloody there.
Yeah, it's never a smooth process.
No. And the crazy thing is, it kept on twitching after I was sure it was dead. So I guess its cells were still responding after its brain was gone. So
that reminds me of when I killed a snake years ago, and I felt so bad for the poor thing. I wanted to get it one clean deal, and I just couldn't.
Right.
It's too tough. It was too strong. So we battled for quite some time, and same sort of thing. I always thought, he's finally succumbed, and then he'd move around, but was still alive. So you hate to do that. You hate the fact that, you know, there's a struggle there, mm-hmm. but in your case, fish is delicious. In my case, I didn't want the snake in my yard. So. There was reasons for those types of things. But those are some of the weekend activities that we enjoyed, that you enjoyed anyway. My snake story is from way, way back.
I did conquer pizza over the weekend, so I did feel exhausted after that as well.
That would do it.
That's true, yeah. Pizza, turkey, any big meal for sure. A lot of great programming today here on KPCG, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Really great show today with your host Stephen Fleury from Edstone, England, talking about Germany is rising on the world scene in dramatic fashion. And he's talking about this particular article that's featured on the Trumpet from the National Interest, March the 26th, how Germany won World War II in 2017, which is a pretty thought-provoking title. I had to read it twice. Wait a minute, they didn't win World War II. Wait a minute, what are you saying? And so it's a really interesting article, and he talks a lot about it on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today. And so that's one you don't want to miss.
Yeah, it's very thought-provoking to realize that maybe, perhaps, everything that's happening in the past 70 years, Germany hasn't, they were defeated technically in the war, but their aims and their goals didn't die with the Third Reich, and they've continued to seek after domination of the continent. And if you look at how the European Union is structured today and the debt and everything like that, you can really see how Germany basically has conquered France, all their major rivals, without going to war. And Britain is eluding their grasp once again with Brexit. But it's scary for those other countries, too, to realize that you're in Germany's hegemony now.
And they're kind of, whitewashed, so to speak. You never hear anybody being very critical of what they're doing occasionally. I mean, back when they were, I guess, back when Greece and all that situation with the economy was more in the news, there would be some protests against the austerity measures and things, but it never really got a lot of traction, and everybody's moved on. Angela Merkel's party won over the weekend. They had a vote, and she won. They thought it'd be closer, and so good news for her, I guess. So she's kind of still has some strength there in Germany for the time being, and that nation is doing a lot. It's talked about here on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. And, of course, why that's interesting to us in particular and to the listeners, many listeners, I'm sure, is that Herbert Armstrong talked about that for a long time right after World War II. And uh, And Key of David presenter Gerald Fleury has been talking about that a lot as well for the last 25-ish years. when you factor in Mr. Armstrong, that's 70, 80 years. So this isn't new news for those that have been paying attention.
Yeah, it was just 70 years ago, and it's almost like everyone has forgotten that history. And if anything, people are asking Germany to get more involved militarily overseas in different countries, and not even just for peacekeeping missions anymore. People are asking them to get involved going on the offensive. So that's something that you could have never imagined people asking Germany to do right after World War II.
Yeah, for sure. The whole goal was that they would never rise again, right? And that was the big push. And now people don't even think about that anymore. But and of course, then with the United States and Donald Trump becoming more isolationist and saying Germany owes us for NATO and so forth, it's just rolling out the red carpet, really, for Germany to take a bigger lead in the world.
Yeah, I think when we historians look back on this, I think they'll realize that Germany's power and their ability to do what they've done has all been given to them on a silver platter by America in the Marshall Plan, rebuilding Germany after it was defeated, with NATO basically paying for the defense of Europe and Soviet Russia, defeating Soviet Russia with going into debt to do that, while Germany can become prosperous. All these different things. Basically, America has enabled Germany's rise. And now, depending on what the administration does, we'll pretty much hand them over Europe as well. Because as long as America's there, Germany can't do it. But if America recedes into the background, in a Germany now that's independent, it's free game.
One of the great points made on the Trump Daily Radio show today is that, you know, you have different nations talking about the EU should fail or it is failing. But Stephen Fleury pointed out one nation never talks about the EU failing, and that's Germany. They never talk about pulling out of the EU because they're using the EU. It's their tool to get their way.
Even if they hope it fails, it really is a way that Germany could never fail by themselves.
They're, like has been mentioned plenty of times, they're taking over Europe without firing a single shot, able to do it economically in other ways as well. So pretty interesting. Make sure you listen for that Trump Daily Radio show today. Comes up here at noon on KPCG, and you can get the archives online at kpcg.fm, too, if you can't watch it or listen to it live, rather. TheTrumpet.com today, too. Here are some headlines. The feature story, Mosul, what happens next? From the ashes of Iraq rises the kingdom of Iran. That's by Callum Wood. A couple of related articles. The Islamic State and Iran on the same team. And is Iraq about to fall to Iran? That's from 7 years ago already. So we've been talking about that for a long time, too. That you knock out Iraq, and then there's Iran, still the power in the Middle East, and they don't have to worry about Saddam Hussein. And so we see them on the rise.
Yeah, that article also talks a lot about how America seems completely disorganized over there when they're in collaboration with the Iraqi forces. For some reason, they're also on the same side of Iran there, but Iran's the only one that seems to be silently, just basically steadily building up their power militarily and politically over there, basically ready to take over Iraq as soon as it completely is open, as soon as the Islamic State is gone.
Yeah, and you know, if you think back to the 80s, Iran and Iraq were fighting quite a bit, and so they were worrying about that battle and battling each other. And now with Iraq out of the way, Iran's free to focus on other things. So that's always kind of the difficulty in removing a dictator like a Saddam Hussein. Terrible, terrible individual, did terrible things. But if you don't put something there in its place, then you give them over to another dictator, which happens to be the leader of Iran.
Yeah, it was really interesting during the Iraq War. Well, how the American government and military is trying to find the right balance of power there, because either you would have a leader try to emulate Saddam Hussein, even with a mustache, coming in the power there. They just, because that's all they've known for the past 30, 40 years, so they would just try to do that again. Or you would have a leader come up who would either try to destroy all the Shiites or destroy all the Sunnis. And so I think for a lot of American people, it's really frustrating to see that all the thousands of American lives, the billions of dollars, all the blood spilled over there is really for nothing. If Iran and their Shiite militias are able to conquer Iraq by conquering the Islamic State, all that sacrifice, all that American hard work over there will be wiped away as soon as Mosul falls. And I think that's frustrating to a lot of the families who sacrifice people fighting over there, but also for the American government, that the trillions of dollars of debt that went into that war, and for all of it to be washed away into nothing.
Well, I wonder how much people pay attention to it even. You don't hear a lot about it in the media. It seems like that's kind of a forgotten area, Iran, Iraq, because there's more focus on what's happening in the U.S., I guess, and, I don't know, Europe, Russia, China maybe?
Syria, too, I guess.
Syria, yeah. So it seems like Iraq has kind of been relegated to the past. Like, it's a historical footnote now, but there's still things going on there and important things, too.
Yeah, it's especially for America, I think we have a lot more invested there than any other country just in the past 20 years since the Operation Desert Storm. But we're pretty much writing it off and probably using it to appease Iran, too. Because if we become more involved in Iraq, Iran's going to push back against us. So it's probably meant to appease them in a way and just focus on the Islamic State, get a quick, easy victory there, look good for the American public, and then move on. Like we talked about last week with terrorism, the problem's never going to be solved until Iran is taken out of the picture.
That's thetrumpet.com. Mosul, what happens next? Make sure you check that article out. We talked over the last few weeks on and off about some odd deaths of animals at zoos. And here's another one. This is from Knoxville. Environmental cause, quote unquote, behind deaths of 33 reptiles. That's quite a few. Zoo Knoxville officials said Saturday that 33 reptiles died at the zoo, including rare and endangered species, very much so endangered because they're dead now, from an unknown event earlier in the week. I mean, how weird, right? They're endangered species and they all die. Well, I guess we were right. They were endangered. Zoo workers found 30 snakes and a lizard, all housed in the same building in the zoo's reptile area, dead on Wednesday morning. The zoo's animal clinic and veterinarians from the University of Tennessee College of Veterinary and Medicine were called in to investigate. The surviving animals were evacuated from the building. So maybe a problem in the building or something, but that killed a fair number of animals, reptiles there at the zoo.
Yeah, that's odd, especially with all the people seems like assassinating rare animals across the world in different zoos. I don't know if this was foul play or an accident or something. But still, it's I think it just shows maybe that zoos maybe aren't the best idea in general. they're neat to see, but I think animals kept in captivity generally have problems anyway. But with these reptiles, hopefully they can figure out what it was. Maybe it's, and hopefully it's not a bigger problem in the zoo that starts affecting more animals there.
Yeah, they said they don't think it was disease, but environmental cause. So something in the building, I'm assuming. So they got the rest of them out of the building, which is strange. What would it do to the people?
Yeah,
I don't know if there's something in the air or whatever, but killed all the snakes. It's always weird to me that the snakes don't kill each other. They're all venomous.
That was my first thought, that it was some sort of all-out snake war in the building. Of
and
course,
one
that couldn't be true, though.
And one lizard. 30 snakes and one lizard. What did the lizard do? I thought the snakes all ganged up on him.
He's probably the first victim, and then they all turned on each other.
Yeah, so really strange. They're going to have to put canaries in there, right? They always put the canary in the coal mine, so you know if things are going bad, so you can get out in time. Put a canary in the snake pit. Of course, the snakes would kill it, so there's really no winning there. But anyway, I thought it was interesting, just because we've seen some of these animals dying at the zoos, which is unfortunate. Here's a write-up from Heat Street. Principal bans kids from reading, quote-unquote, bad books about zombies and vampires. You guys are going to have to look at your reading lists here, see if you should be reading that. The head teacher of a prominent and expensive school for boys has boasted of preventing his students from reading bad books with zombies and vampires in them. Andrew Halls, he's head of King's College School in Wimbledon, southwest London, said that the action-packed books beloved of his students are often not good enough for educational purposes and should be discouraged. I think that's a good idea. Get rid of them.
Yeah, it's finally sounds like a good thing that an administrator is doing. We've heard about a lot of books being banned that have a lot of historical significance, something like To Kill a Mockingbird or even, I think, some works of Shakespeare. So to ban at least things with zombies and what was that other thing?
Vampires.
Vampires. Yeah, I don't even really know what those are, but those things are just pretty destructive to the mind if that's all you're into, especially.
Yeah, the 11-year-olds, that's the age group that they're trying to get these books away from. They don't want them reading books like the Alex Rider spy series and the Artemis Fowl sci-fi novels and other fantastical titles like the Twilight series. So those are pretty popular books. I'm not familiar with most of them. I've heard of the Twilight series. But they don't want the 11-year-old kids reading that in school. I mean, what they do on their own time is their business, I guess, but he doesn't want it in the school.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea because, as a lot of studies have shown lately, a great preponderance of youth basically read these fiction novels, and these fiction novels are pretty much like sugar. There's no substance to them. There's no logic, or just very little you can learn and apply when you're either writing yourself of the English language or just in your imagination of trying to figure out real problems or solving real problems because you're dealing with fantastic situations. So I think this is a great initiative. I think it's a small drop in the bucket, though, when you can see how many of these books are being published every year. But it just reminded me last week I went on a rant at someone's house just about...
Were you invited into the home?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. You went on a rant against
at least,
them.
Yeah, at least my home. Wife was invited into the house. But just all these movies coming out, like Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Slayer, and like a couple years ago, and then Pride and Prejudice, the zombies. Basically, you're taking these classic, noble ideas, and you're corrupting them with these pretty stupid ideas just to get some kind of entertainment money from them. And most people probably have never heard of Pride and Prejudice, younger people, except for the zombie movie that came out, I think, a year ago. Uh-huh. And that's terrible because that's a classic classic literature that most people read to get an idea of Jane Austen in that time period.
The teacher here, the principal, I guess, Halls, he was writing in the Sunday Times. He said he is determined to steer his charges, like the kids there, whose parents pay around $19,000 a year. So this is not a cheap school by any means. Away from what he calls literary fast food, which gets back to the point you made, Abraham, about it being like sugar. And it's interesting because sometimes I remember when Harry Potter first came out and everyone was excited about that. The kids were. Some people said, well, hey, at least they're reading. And they were excited about the fact that they were reading books instead of being on devices of some kind. And so I guess there's that side of it. But then what's the value of what you're reading? That's the question.
Yeah, that's really the concern about this ban as well, because I've even seen videos where the people will be young people will be surveyed like, do you ever read books? And all of them would say no. The only couple who would say yes were reading fantasy novels or sci-fi books. It is almost like if they're not reading that, they're reading nothing at all. So hopefully he puts something else in there to fill the vacuum so they don't turn to video games or smartphones or whatever else.
Yeah, they have some what they think are classics that they put in there, about 300 in total. So they do want them reading the good stuff. And I, you know, talking about being like sugar or being like literary fast food, it changes your appetite. And that's a problem because if all you want to read is these, whatever the books are they mentioned, Twilight and so forth, beyond it not just not being good for you, it's hard to get back into something with more substance because it doesn't taste as good anymore once you've been consuming the sugar all day. You don't want the good food as much. And so I think that's the same with people's reading appetites.
Yeah, and that's the difficult thing is for anyone naturally, I would think historical accounts or maybe autobiographies would be a little bit harder to get into because you would have to think a little bit more. It would be a bit of a deeper bit of source material. But once you get into those and then you just start putting yourself in their situations, I feel like it's a whole lot more enriching than any fake story would be.
It takes a little more time to get into some of those stories, but you get a lot more out of them. The man here wrote, I keep saying good books because, unlike some, I do think there are bad ones, or at least books that are so simplistic, brutal, that they are barely worth reading. He said I wouldn't ban them entirely, but I certainly wouldn't bother recommending them. You know, you can't really get into necessarily banning books. You don't really want that either because there are a lot of good books that people would try to ban. But at the same time, you wouldn't want to recommend some of this stuff to younger students or really anybody for that matter.
Yeah, well, I might have a more biased opinion towards history books, but I think on the whole, when young people, they read romance novels, things like Twilight or anything where it's out the realm of reality and there are these fantastic situations that focus on two individuals, romance, emotions, all those things. Those have their place in everyone's lives, of course, those actual factors in our lives. but they don't develop in their mind the ability to analyze complex situations. It's either to use their imagination to infer themselves into a real account that actually happened in on Earth, or just feel compassion for people who actually did go through disasters and things that helps you shape your worldview. And so when I think when people read these things, it also affects even their emotionally. It makes them more emotionally immature, I think, and creates artificial aspirations of what their life is going to be. Because if you're always reading fiction, that's what your mind's always on. You're always going to be looking to have fiction in your own life. When real life is in the boat, always about romance and spaceships and
vampires.
Fighting wizards. I mean, I haven't met a wizard before in my life, besides some role playing.
You've
park.
Been going to the wrong parks.
Yeah,
yeah. I've seen a few.
But real life is about doing hard things, understanding people, and actually building something that lasts the test of time. And you can't learn those things by reading fiction.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So I think some of those principles are good ones that this band's trying to employ there at that school. Get the kids to read something a little more substantial. Here's a, I don't know if this is shocking, but it's should be, I guess. CNN.com, as more Americans fail drug tests, employers turn to refugees. Americans, there are problems with drugs in the United States. We talk about the problems with the gangs coming across the border and so forth and things like that. Well, a lot of it has to do with the drug problem. And because there's such a drug problem here in the U.S., it allows things like that to fester. And it's happening with employers. The percentage of American workers testing positive for illegal drugs has climbed steadily over the last 3 years to its highest level in a decade. According to Quest Diagnostics, which performed more than 10 million employment drug screenings last year. You guys ever get screened for drugs at a job?
No, actually.
No,
yeah, I never have either.
It would have made no difference.
Yeah.
But
I take that back. I think there was one where I did, but never bothered me one way or the other, obviously. Unless coffee is a drug. They say the increase has been fueled in part by rural America's heroin epidemic and the legalization of recreational marijuana in states like Colorado. Yeah, you can do it recreationally, but you can't do it and go to work. So well, why is it available if it's not legal? You know what I mean? It's strange. Or not legal in certain circumstances. With roughly half of U.S. employers screening for drugs, failed tests have real consequences for the economy. More than 9% of employees tested positive for one or more drugs in oral fluid screenings in 2015, the most recent year for which data was available. And for some companies, it's worse. 20% of people are failing some job applications because of illegal drugs.
That's really strange. It almost makes you wonder why they would keep, why would marijuana be recreational or legalized in almost half the states when you can't go to work? It's like kind of the implicit variable there is that maybe you shouldn't be working either. You should just kind of waste your life away on drugs and get some welfare.
Yeah, that's really a strange thing because there's a lot of jobs, probably any job, but some would be more serious than others, where you could not be under the influence of something and do it because you're operating machinery or, you know, just safety reasons. But yet they say, well, it's okay to do it on your downtime. But you can't do it and be at work, or I think, I don't know how it totally works with some of that, but it stays in your system for a while.
For weeks.
So you're going to fail the test if you're on that.
So you're going to try and take a month vacation every time you decide to do recreational drugs?
I guess. It's really, really an odd thing. But they say the tests, tests for things like marijuana, as mentioned, and amphetamines, all sorts of things, all the way through to crystal meth and heroin, and people are on all of it. And so there are jobs out there, and they're trying to get people to get these jobs, and yet they're too strung out on drugs to actually work for the companies.
Well, I think this is interesting when we talk about unemployment rates and fixing unemployment in America and that sort of thing. That it's not just as simply the government needs to make more jobs, or it's all the administration's fault for one thing or the other. It's a bigger societal problem. I mean, drugs is just one part of it. But if people are having that much problems, and we really need to take another look at this to solve it, because I think I saw something where most jobs by the 2030 or so, 15 or 10% of jobs in America are going to be taken away by machinery. And it's no wonder companies are moving in this direction when they can't even hire people. to do things anymore because either they're too lazy, they're on drugs, they're not willing to get up in the morning to come to work on time. All these problems, and refugees are because they need the money. They're struggling usually to get on their feet. And so the American people aren't making a great case for themselves to have stricter immigration laws or to have better jobs because they're just struggling even just to get a job.
Well, right. I mean, the whole idea of make America great again, if somebody, you know, wants to follow through on that, you've got to make yourself employable first, right? And they interviewed one refugee that was working at a company, and he said drugs just aren't part of our civil, they're not part of our day-to-day life like it is for some people here. So for him, it's no big deal. He doesn't do them. He's not involved in them. But for some people, they're so caught up in it that they can't. They may want to work, but you can't work if you're addicted to a drug.
Yeah, doesn't it seem like the implication for a lot of people who voted for Mr. Trump was almost like, you know, give us jobs. We're not going to make sure we're ready to work hard, but just give us, hand us jobs on a silver platter. That really does seem like the sad reality of a lot of those voters. Not all of them, but a lot of them seem like they had been laid off and didn't necessarily want to change and adapt and make themselves indispensable. They were just hoping that a new president would come in and hand a job to them.
Well, there is this idea of, you know, we're great because we're great, and that's just the way it is, but it has to do with our behavior, and that's talked about in a lot of great books on thetrumpet.com, including Great Again, which you should check out. So kind of an interesting note there about some of the employment in the U.S. Here's a good one as far as employment goes. Evansville woman, 94 years old. She's still going strong. She's been working at McDonald's for 44 years.
Wow.
She's 94, so she started when she was 50.
Wow.
And she's still going. She her name's Lorraine Maurer, and she was honored Thursday for more than four decades of work at a local McDonald's restaurant. Obviously, that's a long time to spend there, but when you're older, you know, something to do. Probably didn't need the money, just doing it because she wanted to. She currently punches a clock at the North Green River location. Dozens of people came in to congratulate her on 44 years of service. That's longer than Ronald McDonald has been there, by the way. Maurer works every Friday and Saturday during breakfast, but you'll likely find her there every day. I guess she just likes to hang out. Nice. She says, I get in here at 5 o'clock when they open. She gets up at 3 a.m. to go to work.
Wow.
94 years old, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I wonder how many chicken McNuggets she's eaten in her lifetime working there.
She'd be the one that they want on that, Super Size Me documentary, saying, hey, now look at this lady.
Yeah.
She's been, nah, I don't know what she eats, but, 94 and still working there. So good for her. You see sometimes you see people do that. It's just amazing they keep going at that age.
Yeah, well, it's a good example for, a lot of people who, I mean, I think a lot of people don't want to work at jobs like that because, I mean, it's embarrassing to their social class, I guess, or just not a job they want to do, and it's maybe dirty and dealing with customers and that kind of thing. But it's a good example that you just have to do what you have to do sometimes, and if a 94-year-old lady can do it, then probably a teenager or if you need to do it for a summer job or just to get on your feet, it's something you have to do.
Well, yeah, you wouldn't have a lot of room for excuses. I just couldn't make it in today. You're like, well, Maureen made it. I think that was her name. Lorraine Maurer. You say, well, Lorraine made it. She's 94. You're 16. You could probably get here. What are you going to say? 94, man. She's seen a lot of history. Pretty amazing. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm. And if you'd like to email us, please send those to comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today. Grant, you've got a write-up for us from the New York Times. Break up the liberal city. What are they talking about?
Well, I've come to rely on sites like this for some excellent analysis of current problems and yet really some truly baffling attempts at solutions for these same problems. This article talks about breaking up the liberal city, which seems to be a good thing. People who are in favor of big cities tend to say, well, all the high-paying jobs are here. College students are flocking here for a great education, but at the same time, the high-paying jobs are there, making living so outrageously expensive that not even the middle class could live there. And also, the students are flocking there, making their campuses, refugee havens and safe spaces. So, I mean, you can say anything positive, and you can offset it with a negative about that big city.
Yeah, that's the truth about big cities. There's cultural events that people like. there's crime that people don't like.
Exactly.
There's, you know, neat things to do and see, and there are places you don't want to get caught in.
Yeah.
Because they're bad places. So that is the paradox of man. There's good and there's bad, and you find it concentrated in those bigger cities.
Yeah, and it does seem like the biggest extremes are in the big cities because, like you said, there are pretty much limitless things you could do in a city if you travel. And even going down the road a few minutes to Oklahoma City, you could do whatever you felt like doing that particular day. At the same time, though, any big city has crime, usually a lot of homeless people on the streets. There does seem to be a higher concentration of problems or things to avoid. The thing is here, though, this author proposes breaking up the big city to try and spread liberalism, get more liberals throughout the rest of the country, which would then help them politically so that they could possibly win in the Electoral College in some elections.
They want to break into the flyover states, as it were.
Right.
The rural America, where it's typically more conservative. It's interesting. I wonder if they've done much of a study onto why it breaks down that way, why it's usually more conservative in rural areas and liberal in the big cities.
Yeah, it would be interesting to figure that out. This author, to be fair, does strike a stunning blow to both sides. He says liberals have become smug, hyper well-educated, and yet just so unbearably arrogant. And then the conservatives have almost gone the other extreme where they're buffoonish and they don't want to go into higher education or go farther in their education at all because of what they've seen from the other side. So that really is a good point. It seems like the two sides are dividing in a pretty stark, alarming way. So both sides clearly have their flaws.
Yeah, it's becoming more polarized.
Yeah,
for sure. We saw that in the election, and you do see that with the way this author is breaking things down.
Yeah, he does make some interesting attempts at solutions. He talks about spreading the media out, getting them out of these bustling coastal cities and into those flyover areas. It seems like his motivation might be to kind of spread their viewpoints among the meanly named flyover states. But it would be nice, though, on the other hand, for reporters to get an experience of what the whole country is like instead of just thinking that everyone in their little bubble in that city is representative of the entire country.
So the author is, even though has more of a liberal leaning, is saying that they should get out and experience, you know, things outside of their bubble, mm-hmm. so they have a better perspective on what other people think.
Yeah, there's definitely some parts of this that make a lot of sense. I just think his overall motivation for it might be a bit lacking. But he does also talk about college campuses having satellite campuses in places along the Rust Belt or in middle America. So maybe like a Stanford Buffalo location, something like that, he proposed. Spreading out the college campuses instead of just concentrating them all around big cities for the most part.
Well, it's interesting, just thinking about the media, because I think the media oftentimes is sort of a reflection of the people that they're talking to. Because I know when I worked in different media outlets, and it was in a rural area, they would always hire companies to find out what people wanted, you know, as far as coverage. And that dictated what they covered, because they're in the business of making money, which means you need a lot of people watching or listening so you can sell advertising. And so they, you know, if you're in a conservative area and you're pushing a really liberal agenda, people turn you off. So in a way, I think it's hard for them to spread out because people will rebuff things that they don't like and they won't watch it. It won't be successful. They tried that with talk radio. You remember they had Radio America or something? Was that what it was called?
Air America, maybe.
Air America. Yeah. I think you're right. Where they said, okay, conservative talk radio is so popular and we're going to have this counterpoint to it, but nobody listened to it. Or not enough people listen to it to make it viable. I don't even think it exists anymore. Mm-hmm. Or if it does, I don't know about it. So it is interesting. A lot of times, the people determine the way it is in a certain area more than even like the media would or things like that. You know, up in Wisconsin, the survey results are people want to know about the Packers and the weather in like that order. And then beyond that, local news and whatever else. But that's what they're concerned about. So that's how the newscasts were set up. Packer report, weather report.
Right. Yeah, it would definitely force the media to try and at least cater more toward people who disagree with them if they were spread out in these areas a bit more. This author also talks about possibly moving regulatory agencies to places like Detroit and Akron. But again, the regulatory agencies, I don't think those would necessarily be a great thing if they're trying to impose more environmental regulations, for example. Maybe people don't necessarily want that to move to their town.
Birds of a feather flock together, right? It's just the way it goes. And so the conservatives tend to kind of spread out in different ways, and then the liberals kind of go their way as well. So it's interesting. It would be good if people could come and kind of find a common viewpoint, but that's very hard to do. Those very different ideologies.
And it also seems pretty difficult to figure out, would it be better leaving it the way it is with conservatives in the middle of the country and liberals on the coasts, or would it be better for each place in the country to be more mixed? I'm not sure which would cater more toward unity or division, whichever one. It seems like we're pretty divided right now. We know who's on which side, who's on whose side, and who's on the other side based on pretty much where they live. That might at least be a little bit harder to tell if we were all mixed together more.
Yeah, but even there, everything is sliding more and more liberal. Even the conservatives are very liberal compared to what it used to be. So it's all pushing that direction. It's all pushing to the left, as I gesture to the right. Sorry, to the left. And so, but more divisive. Even if everyone's kind of drifting more into that, it's lawlessness is what it is. Mm-hmm. Getting away from law, and everyone's kind of drifting that way. Some more starkly than others, or more radically than others.
Right. How often now do you see conservatives with a hard moral stance, at least one that they're willing to put out there? No one would ever vote for them.
Yeah. And even if they feel that way, like you said, they wouldn't get the votes. So in a lot of cases, pretty interesting. It's all a reflection of the people in the country, these different ideas that they have. But again, you can check out Great Again, which is a really good book, and America Under Attack, those two, at thetrumpet.com as well, because besides just identifying some problems, you get some good answers too, which is rare. So, Grant, that article's from the New York Times, Break Up the Liberal City. Thanks for bringing that to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm as well. Abraham, you've got this interesting write-up about supermassive black holes.
Yes.
Always intriguing. Supermassive black hole rocketing through space at a slow 5 million miles per hour. I get 5 million miles an hour. I get going much above 75 in my car. I feel a little nervous.
Yeah, it's a speed we can't really fathom. No. 5 million miles an hour. And this is from the Independent, and basically it's really interesting. The Hubble Space Telescope picked up a black hole moving through space at this speed, and it's odd because usually black holes don't move because everything else is moving towards them because they're pulling everything in.
Yeah.
So they're wondering, well, what's causing this supermassive black hole? It's not just a massive black hole, it's supermassive. And what's causing it to be pulled around at this stunning speed? And it's really fascinating. It goes into the realm of theory because we don't know everything. But basically, when scientists see something like this, the movement of such large entities in space, they're caused by gravitational waves. And gravitational waves were first predicted by Albert Einstein. And basically what a gravitational wave is when two galaxies collide, different bodies inside them collide. And so it causes ripples. If you think of time and space as like on a sheet on a bed or like of a little puddle, when something collides, it creates ripples. And those ripples are gravitational waves. Spreading through time and space, through like the different bodies around them, and so for this black hole, they then think that it's moving so fast because it's caught a gravitational wave and it's pushing it in a different direction, and so this this particular black hole, it's found in galaxy 3C186, very romantically named there, and it's 8 billion light years away from Earth. And they say that in this particular one, they think that this galaxy, 3C186, basically collided with another galaxy, and two black holes inside those galaxies collided with each other because they're moving in opposite directions. And as these two black holes collided, they create gravitational waves. as the two forces are between them are moving in different directions and opposing each other. So that's how they think that this huge black hole is moving so quickly, and that basically it can only move like that because there are even bigger black holes that collided with each other. And just to give you an idea about this black hole, it is it's so big, or I guess its density is so dense that its weight is equal to a billion suns. Hmm. So the mass inside that black hole, the one that's moving at 5 million miles an hour, is the equal to a billion suns in mass. And they think that the two black holes colliding are even bigger, causing these gravitational waves. So the reason this is interesting is just that it's something we don't see too often, and that such a large entity or something that even sucks in light is being dragged across space at 5 million miles an hour, and that there are even bigger forces in the galaxy that affect all these different entities. So some of it is theory, but at the same time, it's just really, I think, awe-inspiring to see that there are forces in the universe that can throw around these massive entities like nothing.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And it is strange, I guess, when I read the title, I hadn't been thinking too much about what black holes typically do, which is suck things into them.
Right.
And so that is really fascinating to see that what's happening out there. The more they look into space, the more amazing things we find out. And he can't even comprehend the speeds and the... And that's why it's really good when it can be broken down into something we can hopefully relate to. You know, 5 million miles an hour. I don't.
Yeah.
This is hard to even hard to even grasp, but pretty amazing stuff going on out there.
Yeah, it's just a small glimpse into what I think just shows us how much we don't know still, and that when we look at the scale of our solar system with like the Sun, Jupiter being the two biggest entities, and then Earth. Just that really everything that we think is massive and big is probably either average or smaller than what we're finding out about the galaxies and the universe around us. So I think it's awe-inspiring to see the massive forces at work, and it's just that they're, even if something collides, like these two huge galaxies collide, there are systems and laws in place with these gravitational waves that kind of help, I think, restore the balance, putting things where they need to be so that it doesn't clash again or create that disturbance.
Yeah, really, really amazing. There's more that you can read about that. Where did you get that from?
The Independent.
Independent, yeah. So if you want to get more into that and stretch your brain a little bit, you can read more about the supermassive black hole rocketing through space at 5 million miles per hour. Pretty astounding. You've got some history for us today as well. This ties back in to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and also to last Friday. There was a historical date there of note. Some of the history of the European Union.
Yes, yeah, I believe last Friday pretty much marked the 60-year anniversary of the European Union. The Treaty of Rome was signed in 1957, and that essentially established the European Economic Community, which is the forerunner of the European Union. And so the European Project, as it's called, has been around for 60 years. And I think it's just interesting to look back on some of that history, especially with Germany. This is talked a lot about at the Trump.com. I think there's two or three booklets you can read on the subject that go into more of the prophetic importance of it. But just talking about the history, I think, especially in relevance to Germany today, it's really interesting to see how the European was set up from the beginning to give Germany an unfair advantage. And the first way this was done is through geography. So Germany and France are the two biggest countries in Europe. And doesn't matter what any other country does, they'll always be powerful because the size, the resources in the country, and then their populations. They'll always be able to field bigger armies. They'll be able to have bigger factories. And then with Germany, they're central in Europe, so they can go east or west, and they kind of dominate the countries around them. So just the very geography of Germany makes it dominant. And same thing with France, too. They're the two big rivals, just in a geographical way. Since Germany was divided after World War II, the geographical domination of Germany was minimized because east half of it was in Soviet Russia. And so I think it's interesting to think about that when the Treaty of Rome was signed and when Western Germany became part of the European Union and the whole system was built, it was only with West Germany. And so I think France and Britain were comfortable that they could dominate West Germany because it didn't have the geographical the geographical power of having it united yet. So when you're dealing with just half of Germany, it's a lot easier than to deal with all of Germany.
Right.
So I think it's interesting just to think about the circumstances in which this began. Was a weak, defeated Germany, half of it that could be used in the West. And so I think France, especially France, felt comfortable they could control Germany to a certain degree. And then Britain felt comfortable that as long as they play one against the other, there will always be this balance of power in Europe. But as time went on, that proved to be a false assumption, that Germany can be controlled in such ways. And the big breakthrough was when Germany was reunited. Before that, through the 50s, 60s, 70s, there was lots of arguments on how the European Union would develop. But until Germany was reunited with the fall of the Berlin Wall, it just was a lot of squabbling, and it wasn't, and nothing approached a federal union of like military and economic power until Germany was reunited. And in 1992, just 3 years later, you have the Maastricht Treaty, which basically created the European Union with its pillar systems, including foreign and home affairs alongside a European community. So in other words, it was the Maastricht Treaty in 1992 that gave the European Union its own like foreign policy, like own diplomats, and it also laid the groundwork for the euro to be launched years later. And so I think it's just interesting that the European Union spun its wheels for 40 years until Germany was reunited. And then 3 years later, you have the Maastricht Treaty, which is a huge step forward in creating this European superstate.
Yeah. Yeah, they're really the power behind the whole organization there, the whole union. And it's always interesting, too, when you look at the development of powers like this. I guess people in general, we can be pretty impatient. You know, the Berlin Wall falls, and they don't go out and take over the world the next day. Right.
Right.
So people say, well, so what was the big deal? You know, and it's been a few years now, but it takes time for things to develop. But those even in government or in politics, like Margaret Thatcher, that have some historical perspective and know it takes a little while for things, even they, Bill, they warn early. You know, she warned about Germany reuniting, you know, that you were hitching the entire union to Germany, not Germany to some other union. And she was turned out to be absolutely right on that. But that's not quoted too often anymore.
Yeah, I think Margaret Thatcher was probably the only politician who saw a danger in reuniting Germany. Even Ronald Reagan, he wanted the Berlin Wall to fall down. I'm not sure if Margaret Thatcher wanted it to, just simply that although she didn't want Eastern Germans to be oppressed by Russia, she did want Germany to stay two countries. Simply because together it was too dangerous a risk and a gamble. Because ever since 1870, when Germany was reunited in under Bismarck, they've been a threat to European peace ever since. And so I think she saw that as a chance for Europe to start fresh without a German state at the center of its heartbeat. But unfortunately, no one ignored her. And in fact, that's the reason why... she was ousted from government in 1990. I think it's interesting, too. Last Friday, Stephen Fleury talked about Michael Heseltine, the former deputy foreign leader for Britain, saying that, well, with Brexit now, Britain pretty much gives Germany Europe because we're leaving the Union. And Michael Heseltine is the same politician who basically ousted Margaret Thatcher in 1990. He's the one who challenged her leadership, which created the vote of non-confidence to where she left and John Major came in. And so I think with Michael Heseltine, he's realizing now the threat that Margaret Thatcher was talking about, and I think he made a grave error in getting rid of the only leader that could stand up to Germany at the time. And ever since then, we've been seeing just how dominant they can be.
Yeah, it just highlights the fact that there's never really a power vacuum very long. You know, I suppose President Reagan was really, I mean, he was really trying to take down Russia.
Yeah.
The Soviet Union, which he did. And but in so doing, then you give rise to another power. So what happens when the U.S. stops being the power? Who rises, right? It does. There is no like equal sharing of power that ever happens historically, where we all just kind of, you know, you do your thing, I'll do my thing. It doesn't work that way. There's always somebody that has to dominate. And so as the U.S. does continue to step back away from the world and be forced to, just because we're having so many issues, who rises, right? Well, there you got Germany.
Yeah, exactly. And the European system, based off the Maastricht Treaty of 1992, was designed to fail. The economic system was designed to create failure in these debt-ridden economies, especially in Portugal, Ireland, Spain, and Greece, basically giving them loans of the euro money with an interest rate that was the same as the countries with good credit. So eventually, they would borrow themselves into so much debt that they couldn't even pay the interest on it, to where Germany would have to step in like, oh, we'll bail you out. We'll give you all the money you need if you do exactly what we say.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 1992, that set the stage for Germany being able to conquer these countries economically by basically getting them to go into debt so much. Only Germany, who is an export-driven economy, who can export things because the United States lets them, essentially, they can become the only country that can fund the European Central Bank, which gives money to all these countries. And so you can see how it's a brilliant masterstroke, really, that they were able to do this and have the plan, execute the plan over decades and have it work so successfully. So it was a great moment for the people who framed it together, but it is a terrible thing when you have national sovereignty ripped away because a country takes advantage of another's of their debt. And we're going to see the same thing happen to America, too, with China and Japan, who hold most of our debt. Basically, if we don't do what they say, they can get rid of all our bonds and we're bankrupt. Yeah. And we're not going to have a bank that can bail us out like Germany can bail out these European countries, unless we want to become slaves to China. Basically, that's our option. So you can really see how dangerous that kind of economics is. And Germany took full advantage of it.
Yeah, it is amazing that they could execute their plan so well. And, of course, you have to look over at, like you said, China. And they think long term too. They think they think in a very long, long ways off. And so, you can see like the economics, like you say, they don't always come. The exact result of it doesn't always come home to roost that day or you know that week. But over the course of years and decades, all of a sudden you realize you're kind of stuck and you can't get out.
Yeah, I think with especially Chinese traditionalism being very patient and executing plans, and Europeans. Americans are very brash. We want results now, even in how they fight wars. Americans, we go for the big battle at the beginning and then it's over. When we don't, they're great. I think America's great flaw is that we don't win the war for peace, as Herbert Armstrong said, because we're not far-sighted enough to see that you could win the battle, you can win, have immediate results of victory, but how do you make those last for decades? We don't have that vision. Some of it's because of characteristics and some of it's because of how young we are as a country. But other countries like Europe, they've been around so long, they can look back and see what works. Germany has tried to conquer the world twice already. And so based off their failure, the third time they learned their lesson to not start with guns and tanks, but to start by using economic blitzkrieg pretty much and conquering these countries through debt.
And yet, as was pointed out on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this morning, Angela Merkel has like the moral high ground to pretty much lecture everybody, it seems like, particularly President Trump. And yet they've been anything but forthright with what they've been doing economically there in Europe.
Yeah, that's, I think, one of the most frustrating things to me is the hypocrisy of the German politicians. Lecturing the U.S. on immigration, on economic equality, on free trade, when they themselves are probably violate that the most of any country on earth. The only reason their economy does so well with exports is because the European Union is so protectionist. It kicks out Microsoft, kicks out Google, all these huge American corporations. So they have basically a monopoly on the European continent, and they get all tons of money from it. And then also, they're the ones building walls on their borders, keeping out immigrants and all these other things. So despite lecturing Donald Trump on what he can, should and should not do, they're doing everything he wants to do in America because it does work to a certain extent.
It's pretty amazing to look at all that. Look what's going on. Look at some of that history of the European Union. Great content on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today about what's going on there in Germany. Really good write-up that's talked about how Germany won World War II in 2017 from the National Interest. You can find the link there at thetrumpet.com. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you listen for the Kia David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and Music for Life also coming up today as well here on KPCG. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your Monday, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.